All right, greetings. Welcome. Hello, everyone.
Hey.
Okay. So this evening, I'm going to be talking about arrows into flowers. Turning arrows into flowers. I have a little passage on the program there from John O'Donohue about the threshold of the inner and outer worlds. And there's also something I want to read to you. Sure. I'll start with this. Why not? So this is from the Pali Canon. For those of you who are into Buddhism, you know that the original scriptures, the traditional scriptures of Buddhism, would have been recorded in the language of Pali probably 300 to 400 years after the death of the historical Buddha. In some traditions, these are regarded as, whatever that is, written in stone. These are true. He said it. End of story. For other folks in other forms of Buddhism, these are regarded as stories that have been written down by people. Land wherever you like. But in the middle length, there are the short, the middle, and the long length discourses. They've been organized in such a way. The middle length discourses of the Buddha. Oh boy, here comes the Sanskrit word, folks. Bhayabhairava, Bhayabhava, it's a long word. What it means is fear and dread. The Fear and Dread Sutra. The Bhairava Sutta. Fear and Dread Sutra. The teaching around fear and dread. The scripture around fear and dread. It's a relatively long piece. It's, I don't know, 10 pages, something like that. Middle length would be about 10 to 12 pages. So this is my, I'm not actually paraphrasing. I edited, for the sake of this talk, the 6 lines that express the essence of this sutra, to me anyway. So this is in the words of the Buddha. While I dwelt in the dark forest, a wild animal would come up to me, or a peacock would knock off a branch, or the wind would rustle the leaves. I thought, what now if this is the fear and dread coming? I thought, why do I dwell always expecting fear and dread? What if I subdue that fear and dread while keeping the same posture that I am in when it comes upon me? So while I walked, stood, sat, and lay down, the fear and dread came upon me. I did not move until I had subdued that fear and dread. So compared to Zen scripture, this is actually pretty straightforward. Probably means what you think it does. The entire discourse, because it's was written as part of a, would have been recorded as part of an oral tradition, repeats with the 4 postures of man, the sitting, the walking, the lying down, and the standing, what he would do, and it follows this pattern of repetition, repetition, repetition. But the essence is, he's staying in the forest, and people associate being in a dark forest with fear. Makes sense, right? Not always, but he's at night. This is the setting here. He's at night, and he's meditating, and he's being asked by somebody, how come you meditate in the forest at night? He's like, because freaky stuff happens, and I want to understand fear. So he's walking through the woods, and he hears something, and you get that response, right? Ugh. So he stops moving and investigates in his body, in his emotions, in his mind. What is this? Like, what is this? I'm not going to move until I have figured out what this thing is, until I've understood it, until I've felt it completely. And then when he does that, he's like, oh, got it. I'm clear again, okay? And then he's back to moving, and then... So I heard this story years and years ago. I forget how. And some of you probably know this story. It's pretty well known. And what I was struck by was... I was struck by 2 things. I think my first response was, wow, that dude was hardcore. That's just so hardcore. But the second thing I thought was, how efficient. I just love that it's like, I am so aware, I'm being gripped by fear, and he's decided, I'm going to stop every single other thing in my life that I'm doing right now until I've understood what this is. And then I'll move on. Right? What he understands is, if I do not do that, I will be moving on carrying fear. And my perception will be informed by fear. The things that I say will be informed by fear. The actions that I choose to take will be informed by fear because I'm holding fear, right? So what I love here is the layers of awareness. Number one, he's aware enough to recognize I'm experiencing fear. And that seems like a duh, right? And it is a duh for most of us when the fear gets to be like about an 8 or a 9 or a 10. We're right about to lose our spaghetti. Then we're usually aware, wow, I'm freaking out. But what about the 2? Or the 3? Or the 4? And I think all of us have probably had the experience of going, oh man, I'm kind of freaked out. Oh my God, I've been freaked out all day. I was freaked out through the entirety of high school. I was freaked out for 4 years. Oh my God, junior high was even worse. Oh my God, that was like 7 straight years of being... My dad was an abusive alcoholic. I was freaked out the first 18 years of my life. It's like it's the wallpaper of your consciousness, and so you stop seeing it. Like, I'm always scared. I'm always scared. I'm always scared, right? Or I'm always sad. Or I'm always vigilant. Or I'm always, right? So one of the neat things about meditation practice, these examples are always related to the practice of meditation, are one of the neat things is when we sit still long enough, these things get a chance to catch up with us, and they get a chance to be seen. And then we don't only notice we're freaked out when it's an 8, a 9, or a 10. We start noticing when it's a 6 or a 5 or even a 3 or a 2. And you start noticing, when I'm with that person, I just have this very subtle background anxiety. Just subtle. I wonder what that is, right? And so the practice, and of course he doesn't go into great detail about what he actually did, because that's for a different sutra, right? But that sort of freeze, stop, what is this, right? He is, as we say in the Zen tradition, stopping and turning the light inward. He's shining the light of awareness onto the experience. Like, what is this thing? I want to know what this thing is. He's doing what Buddhism does, which is, I notice suffering, and I turn toward it. I get closer to it. I touch it. So that's interesting, isn't it? That's just an interesting little passage. So if you got time to kill, look up the Fear and Dread Sutra from the Middle Length Discourses of the Buddha. I'm not going to try again to pronounce this word because it's not going to happen, you guys. I did it a bunch at home, but anyway. So the one thing I'm going to say before I move on and get to my main metaphor here is in the scripture, the word that Bhikkhu Bodhi, he's the translator of all these things. He's been an unbelievable gift to Western Buddhism. He's translated literally thousands of pages of the Pali Canon. He's just amazing. The word that he has chosen in English for whatever the Pali word would have been is subdued. He subdued his fear. I'd love to have a conversation with him. I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing here, because subdued could mean successfully repressed and ignored, right? Or subdued could mean tame, right? And tame, if you look up tame in the dictionary, it means befriend. Befriend. That was actually revelatory for me. Because when I was a kid, and I was, one of my aunts had horses, you know, and she talked about getting a new horse that was wild, and she would use the word tame. And I'd be like, oh, what is tame? She goes, oh, break. You break it. You break it. You break its spirit so that it obeys you. And you're like, wow, that sounds horrible. And of course, that's what she meant. That's what we oftentimes associate with, right? You break a wild horse. We've all heard that phrase probably. You tame it, you break it. Those are seen as equivalencies. When tame means break, we all know what that means. All of us are broken in some way or another because we have been tamed in that fashion by our culture, by our church, by our parents, by whatever it was, right? We all know that. Subdued, in order for this teaching to be in any way useful to me, can't mean that. It has to mean tame as in befriend, understand, walk with, see through, hold. Does that make sense? Because there is a way of taming an animal that's about making a new friend. And there is a way of taming an animal that's about scaring it so thoroughly that it will always obey you. Right? So most of us as humans, we are, of course, animals. And we are born as animals. And we are born as untamed animals. Right? And all of us, unfortunately or fortunately, had human beings as parents. Oh man, what a bummer, right? But unfortunately, that's what we got. Human beings who have short fuses and their own pain and their own crap and their own whatever. And so even in the best of circumstances with the kindest of intentions, they want to befriend us. They want to tame us. In that sense, they're going to have a bad day. And in that moment, at that time, in the middle of Target, when you are freaking out at two, they don't care about befriend anymore. They just care about shut up because you're embarrassing me. And in that moment, they will choose break. They will choose, I will do something that will make you so scared that you will obey. Right? So for some of us, that's a rare occurrence. It only happened a few times. For some of us, welcome to Tuesday. That was normal. Right? So in order, again, for this teaching to be in any way helpful, From my point of view as a 21st century American, when we talk about the Buddha subduing his fear, we are not talking about successful repression, suppression, denial. Does that make sense? Zen, Zen is not Novocaine. The point of Zen is not to feel no pain. That's not the point. I can subdue the pain in my hand so that I can hold it over a candle flame and not flinch if my hand is properly shot up with Novocaine. That is not what Zen is supposed to do. That doesn't even seem useful to me. I am actively being hurt, and my body is sending me messages of pain, saying, there is pain happening. You need to attend to it. But I don't feel it, so I will not attend to it, and soon I'll start smelling something burning that's me. And the truth is, a lot of us, myself included, spend a huge amount of time, unconsciously, on the cushion in a Zen center doing exactly that. How do I escape from it? How do I go away? How do I feel less? It's not a Zen thing, it's a human thing. This is what humans do, right? Of course we look to spiritual practice to feel less pain. Humans want to feel less pain, that's a human thing, right? It makes perfect sense. Of course I understand that. But that's not what this is here to do. It's not that kind of subdue. I will not move. No. That's not what we're here to do. It is sometimes taught that way. I take real issue with that because I see what that creates. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. If I actually don't feel any pain, I'm an unbelievably dangerous human being, aren't I? Seriously. I'm insanely dangerous to you and to me. Right? Wow. Because I'm not awake. I don't feel. Right? Zen is about feeling more, becoming more human, turning toward the suffering, understanding it, moving into it. That's the spirit of Buddhism, not the opposite. So here's my main metaphor. Here's what I want to talk about. Arrows into flowers. So what we're talking about here is the metaphor that is chosen to describe the second temptation of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. Well, second temptation of Siddhartha Gautama, before he's the Buddha, technically. Some of you who have heard me talk before, for whatever reason, I don't know why I keep doing this, but man, the three temptations, I keep coming back to this. They just seem such powerful metaphors to talk about the stuff that comes up for us during meditation practice. So we have this wonderful myth, a lot of you probably know it, the myth of the story of Siddhartha Gautama, and he leaves his father's palace, and he's a prince, and he does the 6 years of ascetic practices, and he does all the things that he does, blah, 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 blah. Finally sits down under the Bodhi tree. There's a bunch of different versions of this story. A lot of them contradict one another. I love that. Because that makes me take none of them too seriously. They're very clearly stories made up. I mean, they just are. The reason I can say that with such certainty, at least in my own experience, is they just follow the archetypal thing that every single person does. They represent. They're symbols that represent something, right? That way we can all relate to them. Right? That just makes sense to me. So in the story of him sitting down on the tree and going, I will not move until I've attained perfect freedom, or whatever the language is, he is faced with three temptations. And all the language around these things is roughly the same. The temptations always come in the same order. They are roughly speaking the same thing. When I was Googling this again, because I really wanted to talk about the arrows into flowers, I just entered in the search engine Three Temptations of Buddha, and I forget the name of the site that came up, but I read the description, and I don't know if this was from the Theravadan tradition, the Mahayana tradition, the Zen tradition, the Tibetan tradition. They've got different cosmologies and different belief systems informing the story. But the story, the version that I came across, really made me mad. It was just wrong, wrong, wrong. So I'm glad I forgot where I got it, or else I'd say something unskillful right now. But it was just, I was like, no, you've got it all wrong. So I don't know. I just like that we get to do that in Zen. Go, no, wrong, 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 wrong. No, what are you talking about? That's the origin story of the religion. No, yeah, they got it wrong. Do you know better than that? Yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah, that story sucks. I totally get it in a better way than that. We get to do that. Well, we get to do that when our teachers aren't around. Okay. So our stories and the stories that we live by tell us about ourselves, right? And so part of the Buddhist story is this, the myth of the life of the Buddha and how this human becomes more human, in a sense. Buddhism's a weird religion. Human founder, who lives as a human, dies as a human. End of story, right? You could argue Confucianism is the same thing, maybe. But in terms of world religions, that's pretty unusual. There's usually a divine element or a supernatural element or some sort of, but it's like, nope, born a dude, lived a dude, died a dude, end of story. Wow. So when I say that, when I'm out talking at churches and high schools, they're always really disappointed and they stop paying attention. No magic. No magic, because it's all magic. So, but this is one of the stories that actually informs our tradition. So the three temptations, and I only want to talk about the second one, but I'll give you the overview in case you don't know all three. He sits down under the tree, and he's about to become the Buddha, and Mara, who represents the deceiver. He's the villain of the piece. Roughly equivalent to devil, but I far prefer the translation deceiver. His job is just to lie. Evil, yeah, that word's loaded for me, because I'm a Catholic, right? I was raised Catholic. So, no, I'd like deceiver better, like. So, in the world of Mara, right, his job is to make sure the world stays asleep and deceived and greedy and angry, and, you know, that's his job. He just creates problems. So, when he sees this guy's about to become a Buddha, he's like, oh, man, this is not good for me. This is not good. This is going to be so bad for business. I've got to prevent this from happening. And all the stories talk about how he's like, oh, crap. And I love that they talk about the oh, crap part, because I'm like, well, then you must already... You already know what's going to happen, don't you, dude? You can see the writing on the wall. You know where this is going. You're about to have a really bad night. So that's okay. You get to have a bad night. So he does what Maras do. He sends in the things that he is hoping will drive Buddha from his seat, drive the Buddha to be from his seat. And the first thing he tries is desire. Wow. Desire has prevented more people from sitting on cushions than anything else I can think of. Wow, it's time for my zazen. And watching a movie and eating ice cream would be so much more fun. I will do that instead. Right? That's, we could say, Mara. Isn't there something you'd rather be doing? Oh, yes. I can think about 500 things I would rather be doing than sitting cross-legged and staring at a wall. You don't even have to be a very good Mara to pull this off, you would think. Right? So he sends desire. Isn't there something you would rather be doing? So it doesn't work, of course, because we all know how the story ends. Buddha recognizes what's going on. Oh, I get it. This is desire. This is desire. Of course I want things. Human beings want things. It's a desire. But you know what? I'm going to stay here. I'm going to stay here. I see you, Mara, he says. Poof. Spell is broken. Right? Okay. Didn't work. Damn. Okay, one down. Oh, I know what I'll do. I'll do the opposite. Scare him from his seat. Fear. I'll scare him from his seat. Fear. So he does what mythological beings do, which is gather his army of infinite numbers of demons who all have flaming arrows because that's the technology of the day. This day would be, I don't know, automatic rifles, I guess, with their arrows, and they fill the sky with black sheets of arrows all descending upon the Buddha, right? This is fear. If you stay there, you will be killed. Scare you away, right? It's the Scooby-Doo villain tactic. There's gold planted here, and if I just trick you into thinking it's haunted, you'll leave, and I'll get to keep my gold, right? It's not advanced, complicated stuff. But again, this works. People sit every day. They're really devoted for about 6 months, and then something starts moving in them, and they go, oh, baby, that's under there. Okay, I gotta go. And they quit. They quit, right? I get that. That's humans. So, well, but here's the thing about the story that's so cool. The image that they use is the arrows are descending upon the Buddha, and of course he knows this is happening. He does nothing. He says nothing. He does not move. He does nothing. And when the arrows enter the sphere of his awareness, they are transformed into flowers, and they fall at his feet. The arrows turn into flowers, right? Third temptation, just for those of you who don't know, is the temptation of shame, right? This is India. It's also just as big in America. But in culture, it's like you have a debt to your mom, you have a debt to your dad, you've got a debt to your wife, you've got a debt to your kid. He had all four of those things. Who do you think you are, sitting and, I'm going to look at my navel and get enlightenment. Really? Oh, you're just going to let it all go, huh? You're going to let these people down, right? The voice of shame. Who do you think you are? Right? And the Buddha passes that temptation by just touching the earth with his right hand. And when he touches the earth with his right hand, the earth herself, it's always a feminine, in every version I've ever read, in fact, she's got a name that I never can remember because I don't know anything about Pali. The entire earth, the entire body of creation itself says, I bear you witness. I say so. That's who says so. All of creation says, you get to sit there and do that. That's who says everything. So Mara goes, wow, I'm done. I'm out of here. So he runs away. Boom. So the three temptations are passed. The Buddha attains enlightenment. He's now the Buddha. So what I want to talk about is that second one, right? Years later, he's then telling this person, hey, how did you defeat fear? And he's talking about his experiences in the forest, stopping moving, investigating his experience, right? Stopping moving, investigating his experience, subduing fear, right? That would have happened before he's the Buddha, right? So this whole myth of all these arrows being transformed into flowers is because he has so successfully subdued his fear, this transformation happens. So that's the image I want to play with tonight. And the reason I think it's significant for a whole bunch of reasons, and I hope to cover as much of it as I can, but the biggest, most important thing to me that happens is that the arrows transform into flowers. They chose that metaphor carefully. Whoever wrote that, wow, that's brilliant writing. That's brilliant writing. It seems obvious to us because some of us heard that story hundreds of times. Like, yeah, I know, the arrows turn into flowers. What's your deal, dude? I get it, right? He passes the test. When we already know the solution, it seems obvious, right? Luke isn't actually going to kill Darth. He's already beat him. So he's not going to kill him. He's going to turn off his lightsaber and throw it away. It's what he's going to do, dude. He's Luke Skywalker. Right? In order to become a Jedi, he can't kill his dad. He's got to turn off his lightsaber and throw it away and go, I will not kill you. I have become a Jedi. Right? We already know the answer. So we go, oh, of course he passed the test that way. The arrows will turn into flowers. What we forget is how counterintuitive that solution actually is, right? Because from conventional consciousness, which is most of us most of the time, and we're being assaulted by the other, we're using arrows here, but this could be your mean boss, your horrible spouse, your argumentative mother-in-law, your horrible government, your awful weather system that insists on having snow on April 15th, right? We're being afflicted from the outside. Our normal inclination is, right, because we're experiencing fear. How do I get rid of the attacker? How do I get rid of the one who's attacking me? That's called a fight defense, right? Second, how do I protect myself from the attack? Called a flight defense or a barrier defense. And then finally, how do I just avoid it entirely? Just escape. Also a flight defense, right? So when somebody's coming after you, and we've all seen American cultural expressions, plays and movies and TV shows, when there's a bad guy with a gun, the equivalent of arrows, what always happens to him at the end? Our collective level of problem solving in our culture in this time is, oh, he dies. Horribly in slow motion, and it's awesome, right? Because some part of us is satisfied at that, like, oh, then he'll never hurt anybody again, end of story. Has fear been addressed? Has fear been transformed? No, I just killed the thing I was scared of, right? So what I'm thinking is, for the average 21st century American, if we're sitting under the tree, right, and this big hail of arrows is coming, we would think, I want to kill the army. I want to give myself a barrier that will protect me from all these arrows. Or I want to somehow escape. Those would be the three things that would be the very first thing in my mind. It would never occur to me, maybe I could transform the arrows. Right? That's very kung fu movie. That's very abstract. That's very trippy. It's not going to occur to us. So, if I were to rewrite the Pali Canon, and I have so far not been invited to do so, I'm just saying, I still have hope. I know something, because I've been sitting in Zen meditation for a long time, and I also know something about human nature because I happen to be one. I also am blessed to have very wise, very compassionate, deeply feeling teachers who have taught me over and over and over, Busho, your fear is part of your enlightenment. Your anger is part of your enlightenment. Your greed, your misunderstanding. They are not separate, they're part. You need to tame, as in befriend, understand, penetrate, transform. The solution is to not no longer feel them, or to successfully escape from them, or to hurt the thing that's giving them to you. Your job is to transform them inside of your heart. So what you need to understand about the three temptations of the Buddha is none of that was happening exterior to him. That was entirely an internal process, right? There's no external Mara who's sending dancing girls and ice cream to tempt him off. There's no external Mara who's sending him spears and arrows and fire. There's no external Mara saying, how dare you? Those are inside of him. And that's actually easy for us to get to because anybody who spent even 15 minutes on a Zafu knows exactly where that stuff is coming from, right? It's all coming up inside you. Doesn't it just show up? Doesn't it just show up? Wouldn't you rather be? Wouldn't you rather be? Don't you wish you would just ring the bell and you could just get the hell out of here? God, later on tonight, I'm just going to eat pizza till I pass out. Right? Hi, Mara, I see you. That would be more fun, wouldn't it? You know what? I'm staying here. You know, if you keep looking, you're going to see stuff you don't want to see. People might not like you. Fear. Oh, hi. I get it. Yep, hello. I see you. You know, your time would really be better spent. Shouldn't you be working that project? That project, you know, that's called productivity. What are you doing now? Navel gazing? What would your dad think if he knew you shaved your head and changed your name? These are not outside of us. This is inside stuff, right? Wow. So here's some alternate versions using the scriptural language, because the scriptural language is always full of this very flowery kind of stuff, which I just dig. I just think it's fun, because it always reminds me, oh, this is a myth, we're making it up. Oh, it's a myth, we're making it up. And I think that's really important. So some alternate versions of the second temptation myth, instead of as the arrows enter the Buddha's sphere of consciousness, they are transformed into flowers that fall at his feet. They might be the world-honored one. That's how they always refer to him, the world-honored one. The world-honored one destroyed the demon army and their arrows with a single thought. Had I read that 20 years ago, it wouldn't even have occurred to me that that wasn't scriptural. I would have been, yeah, that's awesome. That's Matrix stuff. That's great. It wouldn't have occurred to me the Buddha wouldn't destroy an army. Why would he need to do that? That would suggest he's scared of them. That would suggest the army could hurt him. That would suggest there's something outside of him that he was reacting to with a fight defense. That wouldn't be the Buddha, right? Wow. The scripture might also have read Lord Buddha, because they're very fond of calling him a Lord. Lord Buddha armored himself against the rain of arrows with the diamond shield of his luminous consciousness. Seriously, read this stuff. It's full of stuff like that. That makes sense too, right? It's going to fall on me. It's going to hurt me. And so I will protect myself by putting up a barrier it cannot penetrate. It's not what we would do. It's what we would do. But you get that what's happening there is there's no transformation. The arrows are still arrows. He's still him. He just successfully avoided it. With the first scenario, nothing's transformed, nothing's changed, the army's still the army, they're dead now, but the army's still the army, and everybody knows something else about the human experience. At the end of the movie, you know, where the Bruce Willis character kills the villain and he falls to the horrible death in slow motion, we go, yay! Some part of us knows as the credits rolling, you know, there are a lot of villains out there. There's a lot of them. He's going to get about 5 minutes off right now, and then he's going to have to jump right back in again because there's going to be another one, and there's going to be another one. And it's going to be another one because you know what? Fear keeps coming, right? The thing that you were the most scared of in the entire universe when you were 5 years old and you just thought, if I can get past this one, it'll be smooth sailing, right? And then there was another one when you were 6 and 7 and the thing that terrified you when you were a grad student and the thing that terrified you last week and then, right? They keep coming. How long is destroying the thing that's attacking you and avoiding the attack effective? For a minute or two? For a day or two, maybe even for a year or two. But you sort of get it, right? Buddhism is about transformation. To transform the thing. Not to just successfully avoid it. Right? So neither one of those two would have worked. And then finally, these were fun to write. I just had fun going, like, imagine that you're writing scripture. It's really good that you're not. But just imagine that you are. The great Buddha ignored the arrows and spears and he escaped into the transcendent state where he could not be touched. Oh, God, that sounds sweet, right? Like, oh, my God, there's a monster in my room, so I'll just go up into the attic. Right? Wow, great. I don't know if you guys had monsters in your rooms when you were kids, but I did. In the attic. Anyway, so I'm being a little glib, but you get what I'm going to here. Fight defenses, flight defenses. Fight defenses, flight defenses. Fight defenses, flight defenses. Are they useful? Yes. This is not an anti-defense talk. The defenses that you have, the defenses that continue to rule a lot of your thought, emotion, and behavior, are your friends. Why? Because they keep you alive. They have kept you alive. Without them, you would not be here. Literally. The other thing you need to know about defenses, that flight thing, is they only arise, and they always arise, in exact proportion to the nature of the attack. They're exactly as strong as they need to be. You hold on to... Does that make sense? If you're that scared of the thing, that's how dangerous the monster was. We don't create fear. We do later, right? We continue to generate fear. But that initial defense that is created when we're really young and we're impressionable and we're creating this thing called conditioned consciousness, that defense is created exactly in proportion to the very real thing that we experience. That we experience is threat, lack of safety, right? So if you go really, really quick to vigilance and you're just one of those really anxious people who needs to take da-da-da-da-da because you're always whatever, it's like, yeah, you know what? That's how real the threat was. That's how far back it goes for you. That's how much danger you were actually in. That's real. So your defense is not some sort of crazy, I must be an idiot because I'm scared all the time. No, you know what? That's the amount of fear it took to keep you alive at one point in your life. You needed to be that vigilant. Do you now? No. But that was adaptive, right? You figured that out because you needed to be. There's a reason when we're being attacked by arrows, we go, how do I kill that guy? How do I defend myself against it? How do I escape? They're the only things I know to do. And I want to stay alive, right? So there's no enemies in this. There's no enemies in this. Even Mara is just Buddha in disguise, right? This is all just a game. But we also have to understand that our experience of suffering is very, very real. And until we start understanding the nature of these defenses, how we bring conditioned consciousness into this world, how we hurt self and other when we're acting from those places, we will continue to create very real suffering. That's a very real thing. Did that sort of make sense, or did I get too psychology 101 there?
I liked it.
It was good. Oh. Yay! Okay. What am I saying there? I just want to make sure before I move on that this is not a fear is the enemy talk, nor is this a fear is the enemy teaching. Right? The Buddha was right to be scared. When you sit in meditation, you will see and you will feel stuff you do not want to see and do not want to feel. The reason the path of the Buddha is so is because you are the one who chooses to do it anyway. I will choose to have awareness. I will. Because on some level I know if I don't see it, it will continue to rule me. Of course it will. I'll spend my entire life trying to kill the attacker and run from the attacker. That's all I will do. And that's the truth of most humans' lives since the dawn of time. That's just true. We're being assailed by our lives. Do you guys get that? Stupid life, right? Stupid boss, stupid spouse, stupid weather, stupid government, stupid parking regulations. I don't know what. We're assailed all the time. The things outside of us. So I'm forever reacting, reacting, reacting. Is there love there? Is there joy there? Is there compassion there? Is there transformation there? No. God, it's just an animal reacting. And most of us will live, if we're really lucky, 90 years in that place. And if we're really, really, really lucky, in the end we'll see something and go, oh, I see. Oh, I see. None of that came from here, ever. Right? Oh, it's heart-wrenching, isn't it? To think? That's heart-wrenching. So the path of Buddhism is about how do I turn toward it now? Turn toward it now. Turn toward it now. Transform it now. Is there a monster under your bed? God, get out of bed. Turn on the light. Look. Right? You're scared. Right? You're not scared because you're stupid. Don't try to argue yourself out of it. Go look. Yes, it will take courage. Of course you'll be scared to do that, but you get to. Doesn't party you wanna? Like you're bigger than you think. Come on, do that. Do it. Think of how liberative that'll be. But we want to allow our fear. We honor our fear. We accept our fear before we transform it. That's why the transformation metaphor in that story is so crucial. The arrows are accepted as arrows. Oh, yep, I'm sitting here and here they come. It's not denial, it's not escape, it's not... And because the sphere of his awareness is a heart energy. I say heart as opposed to head, although that distinction is never made in the scriptures, because awareness is awareness is awareness, right? In Buddhism, mind with a capital M means this thing, right? It's the fact I can feel it when I do that. It's the fact I can smell my toast when it's burning. It's the fact I can remember being in fifth grade. It's the fact I have dreams for the future. It's the fact I get sad every time I watch Titanic, even though I know it's a movie. It's the reason that I get angry and that I have daydreams about pizza. All of that is consciousness, consciousness, consciousness. That's mind, capital M, mind, mind. Right? The source of that, though, and I'm using the word heart tonight, because he's talking about fear. And we don't defeat fear. We don't defeat fear in the noodle. The noodle helps. The noodle helps, but we don't. It's not transformed up here, right? So when we were a little kid and we were experiencing fear, right? There's a monster under our bed. We know it. No kid comes running out of their room at 2 in the morning going, I think there's a possibility that there might be a monster under my bed. Mm-hmm. They come out at 2 in the morning going, there is a monster under my bed, and if you don't come in here, it will devour me messily. It will not be neat. It will messily devour me, so in the morning when you come in to wake me up for school, it will be horrible. So, parents can do any number of things, and I'm using this as an exterior metaphor for your own fear when it shows up and goes, aren't you scared? Aren't you scared? There's a lot of bad stuff happening. People think this stuff about you. What's going on? What's going on? Right? Fear, 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 fear. When it shows up, we generally meet it from our heads, because that's how our fear was met. There is no monster under your bed. You're 5 years old. You're too old for that sort of stuff. Go back into your room and go to sleep. I am presenting my parents with an experience called fear. They're responding with something called rationality. That does not work. Are they right? Of course. There is no monster under my bed, right? The other option, which parents have, which we all have when our fear arises, is I see that you're scared. I see that you're scared. I see that you're scared. Why don't you tell me about it? Why don't you sit right here, very close to me, and tell me about how it is to be scared? And you know what? When we're ready, then why don't we go in together? Should we go in together? We'll go in together. Into your room and we'll look. Why don't we look together? I am with you, and we will investigate together. But this with has to happen first. If it doesn't, I'm trying to rationalize it away, judge it away, criticize it as being unworthy. Does this happen to you when you get really, really anxious about something? You're like, why am I this anxious about that? Right? On a scale of 1 to 10, I'm up here like 8 or a 9, and it's just a business meeting. That's like a 4. And so you try to talk yourself out of the other 6. By just reminding yourself, you're not going to die, you're not going to die, this is just a business meeting, what is wrong with you? Can you feel the criticism there? You know, you're bringing me a 9. You don't have a 9. Go back in your room and, right? That's what you're doing to yourself. What that isn't is compassion. That is not compassion. The heart of Zen Buddhism, the heart of all of Mahayana Buddhism, is something we call the Bodhisattva ideal, compassion. The transformational potential of being with suffering in such a way that it is transformed. Transformed, right? When I'm with suffering, something happens that is transformative. It is no longer my enemy. It is my teacher. Right? So when you are experiencing an 8 or a 9 of anxiety about this business meeting, right, that's coming up tomorrow morning at 6, it's too early for a business meeting. What were they thinking? My God, they must be Zen people. This is horrible. And you know in your rational head, which is your ally, thank you, rational head, you know that that's about a 4 tops. And you're up here at a 9, you know 5 of those are unexplained points, if you don't mind me indulging this metaphor. Then the beautiful brain can help you by going, you know what? Then 5 of those are about something else. It ain't about the business meeting, sweetie. So what's still stored in your cells? What are you still carrying that you haven't seen, that you haven't held, that you haven't understood? Because it's not going anywhere. Right? Everything you have not fully brought into consciousness, you carry with you. That's just true. Science now shows it this, but Buddha's been teaching this forever. Right? If he's in the jungle, and he's scared, and he hears the thing, and, okay, just ignore it, ignore it. You're fine, you're fine, you're fine. Calm blue ocean, calm blue ocean, calm blue ocean, calm blue ocean. I'll just keep going, right? He can do that, because we all do that. And there are times that's the skillful thing to do because you can't stop and do the weird thing. But if you have the time to stop and do the weird thing, none of that is being stored in your cells and your emotions and your thoughts. And if you calm blue ocean, calm blue ocean, calm blue ocean your way through it, yeah, you survived. Good for you. You regulated your system. Well done. You got stuff done. Well done. And what happened to all that stuff you didn't just feel? Did it just poof? Did you successfully escape? No, you think you did. And then it'll come out 5 years later when you're yelling at your wife for putting her wet towel on the bathroom floor again. Why, right? What's going on? It didn't go anywhere. It's called karma. You didn't figure it out. You didn't process it. You didn't feel it. You didn't love it back into the light. That's called compassion. Jizo Bodhisattva, Kuan Yin Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, compassion. I will feel it with you. That's what it means. Compassion. With suffering. Arrows into flowers. That's the ideal in Mahayana Buddhism. With suffering. Not brilliant at killing a thing that causes suffering. Not successfully shield itself from suffering. Not so drugged up it doesn't even feel that it hurts. Not amazing escape artist that always seems to get out at the last minute like James Bond. No! Isn't it crazy? This is so counterintuitive. We think we get it and we still don't. Because suffering shows up and we still go, how do we get out of this one? How do I get out of this one? How do I get out of this one? Right? The very first word of our central scripture, the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara, the very first word. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. The very first word, compassion, 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 compassion. Maybe I can think my way out of this. Compassion, compassion. Maybe I can kill the... Compassion, compassion. Maybe I won't... Ugh! Of course we do this. We're very human. So I love this metaphor. We transform, we transform, we transform, we transform. How do we do it? I'll try to be very short because I'm running long, as I always seem. There are many different ways of talking about this. I prefer to think of Zazen, as transmitted through Dogen and our subsequent teachers in the Soto Zen tradition, as embodied compassion practice. The way Zazen is taught sometimes, you would get the impression the idea is to trance out. I want to apologize on behalf of 800 years of Zen tradition for that misunderstanding. That is not the correct teaching. And I know that because it doesn't work. And I also know that because I've talked to lots of people over the years who do lots of Zazen who feel amazing on the cushion and then the bell rings and they've got to go back to their life and nothing has changed. That's true. Meditation can be that. It can be what we call spiritual bypass. For half an hour I feel great. Good. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not bad. You just didn't transform anything. You just successfully escaped from it. That's all. It's fine. It's especially good when you're up here 8, 9, 10 and you're freaking out. To self-regulate, well done you. I think you get to do that. But if you actually want to transform the roots of your suffering, escaping doesn't work. Duh. Doesn't work. So one of the ways, there's a million different ways, but one of the ways we are encouraged to use the cushion, encouraged to use zafus, encouraged to use zazen practice itself, is the metaphor that Jack Kornfield uses. He's not a Zen guy, but this is a good metaphor, a good acronym. A lot of you know it because we used some of his books years ago during practice periods. He says rain. That's the metaphor we use. What do we do in the cushion? How do we actually transform suffering? Rain. R-A-I-N. R is recognize. This is what's happening. I feel scared. That's the duh that I talked about earlier. But it's not a duh because, as we know, a lot of times we're experiencing stuff we don't know. So first, just recognize. This is what's happening. This is what's happening. I'm really sad. I'm really scared. I'm really content. I'm really hopeful. I'm really confused. I'm experiencing five different things at once. At least start by noticing. Mindfulness 101, right? Recognize it's happening. Do you feel the power there? You get to choose to know what's happening to you. That's cool. You get to make a choice to know what you are experiencing. That's incredibly powerful. Because then you can actually act in accord with what's actually happening, right? Recognize. So that's why the second step, A, is accept. Say yes to it. There's a difference between, when I first read it, I was like, oh, recognize and accept are the same thing. And then I started watching myself going, oh, no, they're not. I recognize I'm in a traffic jam, but I do in no way accept the fact I'm in a traffic jam, and I'm going to be right in the bumper of the person in front of me and swear the entire time, right? Because I'm a 2-year-old having a tantrum. I know that my curfew is 8 o'clock, but that is unjust. And so I'm going to fight it and fight it, right? So to accept is to actually make a choice. I am choosing to say yes to this. I will allow this to happen. That does not mean condone, endorse, continue, water, sustain. It doesn't mean any of those things. It's just recognizing, all right, I'll let you in. Come on, let's do this. I'm not nuts about this, but I'm accepting the fact this is happening to me, right? R is for recognize, A is for accept. This is where the rubber meets the road. This is where all the mud is for us. This is where the lotus grows. Investigate. I is for investigate. It's also for the interior. It's inquiry, inner work. This is where something happens inside here. How do I transform my suffering? I turn toward it. I get closer to it. I hold it. I actually will literally envision myself going, hello, fear. I'm going to put you on my shoulder like a baby. That's how close I'm going to be. I want to feel your breath in my ear. And I know you're screaming. I know you're crying. I know you're, right? But in order for me to understand what's going on with that baby, I've got to be holding it. Then I can figure out, do you got a poopy diaper? Are you scared? Are you cold? Are you hungry? Right? But do you yell across the room, hey, baby, what do you need? I notice you're screaming. Of course you don't, because you're not an idiot. You have to pick it up. It cannot talk to you. And your deepest fear cannot talk to you either. It doesn't know words, because it was written into your cells way before you knew language. I promise. The very first time you got scared, you did not know the sentence, I'm experiencing fear. I'm scared of this particular outcome because I'm an individual entity and the world is acting upon me. You did not know that. But it's written right into the cells of your body. It's in your bones. So will it show up as sentences? Yeah, maybe. Images? Possibly. But it might just be a feeling that just wants to go, ah! And you have got to pick that thing up and hold it. That means saying yes to it, and that means being the grown-up who holds it and goes, I gotcha. Take all the time you need. Take all the time you need. I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going to argue with you. I'm not going to shame you. I'm not going to criticize you. I'm not going to demand explanations of you. You are an experience of consciousness. I'm not going to demand anything. I'm just going to hold you and be with you. Compassion. That will transform that experience. The only thing, legitimately, that will transform the experience of a crying baby is to just hold it. Hold it. Hold it. Hold it. Sometimes it shuts up just like that. Sometimes it shuts up after a week. Right? And you do have other choices. You get to leave the house. You get to yell at it. You get to hit it. You can do those things. And that's normally what we do with our own suffering. What is wrong with you down there? Aren't you supposed to be a Zen student? How come you're so angry in traffic? What the? Right? The critic is right there. The judge is right there. Right? The shame is right there. It's what we do with our own suffering. We distance ourselves from it. We run from it. We want to kill it. We want to amputate it. We want to escape from it. We want to anesthetize ourselves. Compassion is incredibly powerful practice. It is heavy lifting. Very, very difficult. And so if you're like me, you can hold it for about 5 seconds at a time. And then, okay. You got this. Back in again. Hold it for about 5 seconds at a time. And whoa. And I watch myself pull away. I watch myself go up into my head. I watch myself go into, how long is this going to last? How long is this going to last? I watch myself escape into the past. I watch myself, right? Of course I do. It's really hard. Because there's an ocean, right? When they said there's clouds of arrows, there are clouds of arrows. But they get to all transform into flowers. If we are patient, if we are gentle, if we are kind, the very final thing that happens after the investigation and the inner work and all this interiority and all this inquiry is finally N, non-identify. It's not me. It's one of my experiences, but it's not me. I'm the one holding it, right? Do you get it? When a two-year-old has a tantrum, there is only the tantrum. The two-year doesn't know, I'm having a tantrum. There have been times when I haven't had tantrums. Someday I won't have a tantrum, but right now I am. No. All they are is tantrum. They have always had tantrum. There will always be tantrum. There's only that, right? They don't have ego development yet. They don't have a sense of time. So when we collapse into the experience, that's not compassion anymore. Now there's not a loving parent and a screaming kid. There's just two screaming kids, right? Or the other extreme doesn't help of distancing, avoiding, right? No. Only that grandmotherly mind that Dogen talks about. Pick it up and hold it. It'll hurt. But you know what? You get to be the grown-up. you can stand up and say, I will be here with you. This is a bodhisattva vows. Beings are numberless. And I will free them. I'll be right inside of it with them. I'm not going anywhere, and they're not going anywhere until they are free, until I am free. There's only one salvation project in Buddhism, and it's every single living thing forever. That's who gets free. There is only that, right? So if I refuse to be present to my own suffering, then I refuse to be present to the world. I refuse to be present to it. I can't. I can't begin to. So, I'll close with this. Fear is not our enemy. Thank you, arrows. Thank you, thank you, thank you. If I successfully avoided all the fear in my life, can you imagine? Can you imagine? I'd have no strength, no resiliency, no kindness, no compassion. I'd be the most dangerous thing in the world if I had successfully rid myself of that feeling. So when fear shows up, it's like, oh, here's my signpost. Here's something I can become free with. Here's something that I can feel and befriend and understand and be with and transform. Here's another crying baby. Here we go. Here's my chance, right? Fear is a signpost to freedom. Freedom is a choice. Freedom is a choice. Compassion is a choice. Awareness is a choice. We choose, right? And our vows in Zen Buddhism is to make our lives a commitment to that choice. There is only that. I will get closer. I will open my eyes. I will see it. Will I do it perfectly? Not a chance. Who cares? Practice enlightenment. One thing. Say yes. Go in. Hold it. Try. Fail. Befriend the failure. Go right back in. Pick it up. Hold it. Try. That's a choice. There's tremendous freedom in that. So please make that same choice. Make that commitment to freedom. Make your life a commitment to that freedom. And practice, please, on the cushion and off, as if your very freedom depended on that choice. Because it does. That's true. Thank you. Thank you very much.